So for those of you who've been to my previous lectures in this series, we've been talking a lot about the kind of fundamentals of evolution. So what is evolution? What are mutations? What is the role of chance in evolution? Tonight, we're going to change direction and become much more personal and think only about evolution in the context of ourselves. And in particular, the question that I want to ask, and I'm going to give you a spoiler alert, I'm not going to answer it. The question I'm going to ask is, why are we alone on the planet? Why are we the only species of human? And I think if you think about that at sort of, you know, very glancing moment, you might think that's a completely trivial question, but actually it's not that trivial. And for those of you who are, you know, perhaps fans of science fiction, there are lots of great science fiction movies where you see, you know, your hero go into a bar and there are all these different species at the bar, all chatting away in multiple languages and ordering drinks. And actually, if you look around the world, there are lots of instances when very, very similar species live cheek by jowl. But as far as I can tell tonight, at least in this room, if I look around the room, I think we are all human. No one's sort of interloping from a different species here. And it's not, though, inconceivable to have a sort of parallel planet in which we were a mixed species, right? I could be giving this talk in multiple languages to multiple different species, all bipedal, relatively intelligent, ape-like organisms, and interacting together. But we don't live like that. So there is something that has happened to make humans the only human species on the planet. We don't know the answer to why, but what I want to do tonight is think a little bit about how we got here, and maybe speculate a bit about the factors that might have driven that evolution, and perhaps even going forwards, think a little bit about where we might go from here. So before we think about why we're the only species, it's quite important to think about what a species is anyway. And that's not actually a very straightforward question to answer. There are several definitions of what a species is out there, but perhaps the one that is most widely used and most kind of functional is the one proposed by Ernst Mayr, who you see here, which is known as the biological species concept, which in essence says that a species is a group of individuals that reproduce successfully together. And it's important to say successfully, so this is not just about an ability to reproduce, but an ability to do so in a way that maintains the species. So if most of your offspring die, for example, then actually that's not a successful reproduction. You have to be able to reproduce successfully. And that group is reproductively isolated from other such groups. So in other words, you're not breeding with other species, you are distinct entities. And as we'll see later in the lecture, that actually is quite a tricky thing to define and quite problematic, particularly in the case of humans. But nonetheless, I think it's probably still the best example or the best definition we have of species. And by that definition, then Homo sapiens, our own species, is indeed both of those things. We can all reproduce together, and there aren't other species with which we reproduce.
The Gresham College lecture that you're listening to right now is giving you knowledge and insight from one of the world's leading academic experts. Making it takes a lot of time. But because we want to encourage a love of learning, we think it's well worth it. We never make you pay for lectures, although donations are needed. All we ask in return is this. Send a link to this lecture to someone you think would benefit. And if you haven't already, click the follow or subscribe button from wherever you're listening right now. Now, let's get back to the lecture.
And that, in its own right, raises an interesting question. And the question essentially is not why we're only one species, but why don't we have another sibling species that looks a lot like us on the planet? Because lots and lots of animals and plants do. So, for example, if you're a lepidopterist, if you're keen on butterflies, you'll be familiar with these chaps. These are the Heliconius butterflies, and they're a complete nightmare because they all look the same, but they're actually many, many different species. In fact, in this particular diagram, each pairwise comparison are two different species. And I don't know to you, but certainly to me, it's very difficult to tell those apart, and yet they are distinct. So there are lots of sister species in this genus. And the same holds true for lots of other animals. So I'm a bit of a birder, not a good, very good one, and definitely not good enough to tell these apart. This is the Clarks and Western Grebe, or possibly the Clarks and Western Grebe, depending on which way around they are. And these are two distinct species of bird, and yet they are almost impossible to tell apart in the field. And in fact, these are a North American species, but closer to home, for example, in the UK, we have the marsh tit and the willow tit, and you've got to be a pretty advanced ornithologist to be able to spot the difference between those two species in the field. So there are lots and lots of examples of species that are very similar, living relatively close to each other. And yet we don't go down the road and pop into the supermarket and see something that looks like a bipedal, hairless, intelligent ape, but isn't actually a human. We are, as far as we know, alone. Or are we? I mean, the first question, perhaps, is might we have missed something? And one of the things that people occasionally speculate about in the press is maybe we have missed another related species of human. And actually, that's not completely impossible to think about. Because even today, in the 21st century, in this very developed kind of world in which we live, there are large areas of essentially unexplored wilderness. So in fact, in this estimate from 2018, almost a quarter of the world's land surface is still classed as wilderness, i.e. it has relatively little human habitation or human activity, shown here. So it's perhaps possible that you have some other species living in these wilderness areas, although, of course, even wilderness areas are visited relatively frequently by tourists or explorers or mountaineers or whatever. So it seems a bit unlikely that you'd have large populations of another human living in those locations. There are some parts of the world, of course, that are completely unexplored. And by recent estimates, it's about 2 or 3% of the world's land surface has genuinely not had humans access it. And so there, of course, you may have some other species hiding out. The problem is that 2 or 3% of unexplored world are largely things like remote mountaintops, the middle of Antarctica, places that are not compatible with human life, or at least human life as we know it now. It's possible, of course, that there's some species that can live in the middle of Antarctica and is happily roaming around there and we don't know about them, but they would look quite different to modern humans. I think it's fairly unlikely that they exist. Never say never, but I'm going to place some decent money that there probably isn't a second species of human that we haven't discovered yet. So what about the second possibility? Maybe there is a second species lurking right under our noses. And actually, if you were an alien zoomed down onto this planet and you looked at the fantastic diversity of humans on it, you might reasonably think this is not one species, right? We come in all sorts of different shapes and sizes and colours and cultures and societies and family structures, and we do all sorts of different things that I think if you were looking at it in another species, you might reasonably think represented different groups of people. And this, of course, was something that early explorers, European explorers in particular, floated as ideas. And in fact, even quite late into our kind of exploration of the world, people were speculating on this. So this, for example, is a picture of Charles Darwin arriving in South America on his voyage on the Beagle. And when he arrived there, in his diary, he noted many, many interesting interactions. One in particular with the native population of Tierra del Fuego, the Fuegians. And in his diary at the time, he noted this. He said, "Viewing such men, one can hardly make oneself believe that they are fellow creatures and inhabitants of the same world." This was obviously relatively late. This is well into the 1800s. Prior to that, European explorers had met native indigenous populations in many countries and had repeatedly come up with this suggestion that maybe these were distinct. And this, of course, this pseudo-scientific idea was the horrendous justification used for real tragedies like enslavement of people in Africa and the eradication of Native American populations in a deliberate genocide by Europeans. The point about all this, though, is that it is completely untrue. We know, and we knew actually from the very beginning, the very first interactions of Europeans with native populations elsewhere, that we are one species. Either through coercive or sometimes consensual relations, we knew that people could have perfectly successful children together. And actually, one of the great revelations of whole genome sequencing today is that many of us, perhaps even in this room, realize that we have a very interesting blend of genetics from all sorts of populations in the past. Because, as we now know, all humans all around the world are one species and able to reproduce together. So we're not overlooking some secret second species within our own group. Neither do we have a hidden species somewhere else, nor are we overlooking something here. There is a third possibility. And the third possibility is maybe we're overlooking a sister species that we talk about all the time. So we are, as you well know, hopefully, are great apes, and along with the other families of species in the great apes, we all share many characteristics. And our closest relations, as I'm sure you know, are the chimpanzees and bonobos. So perhaps I'm standing here saying we're alone as a species, and I'm talking nonsense, because maybe these are our sister species, and that's a possibility. They look a little bit different to us. They're much hairier, for starters. But actually, they're very, very similar. And in fact, by genetic data, we know that we share something like 98% of our genome with chimpanzees. That's pretty high. And so perhaps chimpanzees are actually a sister species to humanity. However, if you look at that level of genetic preservation, within humans, the amount is much, much more consistent. So typical, in a room like this, a typical human-to-human comparison shows 99.9% DNA identity, and even the most diverse humans still share something like 99.6%. So the differences between any two humans in terms of genetics are an order of magnitude smaller than the differences between ourselves and chimpanzees. Perhaps more importantly, chimpanzees, of course, have a sister species, bonobos, and if you look at those, the genetic distance between them is about 0.4%. In other words, the difference between a chimpanzee and a bonobo is about the same as the difference between a human and a quite different human from the same species. So these two are indeed sibling species, but they are not a direct sibling species to human. The distance is much higher. So it doesn't matter which way you look at it, whichever way we bore this question, it does indeed appear that we are on our own. We are the only species of Homo, the genus that we're in, that is currently on the planet. So then maybe there's not a problem here, because maybe actually we have always been alone. Perhaps Homo came into existence, and we have been a solitary species essentially for all of our history. And this question, or this suggestion, I guess, was not problematic for most of human history. Because, of course, for most of human history, certainly in Western Europe at least, the predominant rhetoric has been one of biblical creation. So the idea that humans were created as a species to have domination over all other species. So it would make sense in that particular view that we were alone. Because if you're going to create a species to dominate all the other ones, you probably wouldn't create two, because that's going to be problematic. And so up until sort of the 1700s, this was not a particular issue. However, as Darwin's theory of evolution by natural selection took hold and people started to really understand this principle, they began to question more and more this idea about why humans should be so different to everything else. If species arise by natural selection, by diversification, then why should human species be anything different to anybody else? Why haven't we diversified? Why don't we have these sibling species? And this problem, I guess, was kind of rumbling around, particularly in the more learned, more kind of liberal Victorian society, at least in England at the time, and across actually many of the learned cities of Europe in particular. And people started to ask questions about some of the artifacts that had previously been reported, particularly from mining expeditions. And so actually for many decades, people quarrying for stone for buildings, for example, had occasionally stumbled across weird and wonderful things that we would now call fossils or archival material. Sometimes these were animals, often they were animals, but frequently they came across things that looked pretty human. For example, like this skull dug out of a quarry in Gibraltar in the early 1800s. When they'd done that, these were typically described, by the scientific community at least, as archaic humans. So they were humans that had been around for a long time. There was also a sort of interesting and slightly amusing and quite disturbing in some ways sort of a trade, if you like, in these things were associated with crazy myths. So people say, oh, they're extinct giants, or they were kind of mythological 12-headed beasts or something. And there was a kind of roaring circus trade in demonstrating bits of scary monsters that came out of quarries. However, now we know scientifically that was not true. So these things had been found for a period of time, but had always been attributed to Homo sapiens. So people would say these are old, archaic, long-dead humans. And then in 1856, this part of skull was found in Germany in the Neander Valley, and was successfully identified by a German school teacher, actually, as being distinct enough from Homo sapiens to be a different species. And this is the species that we now know as Neanderthals. And once that view had been promoted, that this was a different lineage of humanity, people went back and looked at other material, including this skull from Gibraltar, and realized that this skull was actually much more similar to this new Neanderthal skull than to modern humans. And so actually much of the fossil material that had previously been identified was now realized to be Neanderthal material rather than human material. And so this, which is also going on in the context of the same time, for example, as Darma was publishing his book on the origin of species, was kind of entering this sort of very intellectual debate around diversification and about evolution of humans. It still, though, didn't really change our view about humans being a kind of solitary species in existence. However, in 1891, this rather dashing chap here with the nice moustache, Eugène Dubois, who was a Dutch anatomist, was working in what was then the Dutch East Indies, now Indonesia. And he was particularly interested in some of the remains being found in caves as people pushed on up, and particularly the logging industry as they started to roam into the rainforest would come across sometimes caves with bone remnants. He started to collect some of these and classify them together, and realised that one collection of skeletal material belonged to something that looked very human-like. He actually misidentified this and thought this was an extinct species of great ape, gave it a different name and published it, but people, once it was sent back to Europe, did not agree with this and relatively rapidly realised that this was a second example of a distinct species of now extinct human-like organism, so within the genus Homo, and this is what we now know of as Homo erectus, a long-extinct ancestor of modern humans, and for which there's now fossil material from many other locations around the world. So now, as we start to turn into the end of the 1800s, we have a position where there are at least two species of Homo, so Neanderthalis and what is now Homo erectus, that we think have existed and no longer do exist. So the world is starting to view the fact that we perhaps haven't always been alone through quite a different lens. And then this third piece of the puzzle, if you like, comes around in 1907 with this chap with the even more dashing facial hair. The beards get longer all the time, I think. This is Otto Schutensack, and he was a German industrialist, and I really like this story because he was actually, as a relatively young man, he was a chemist, and he set up factories producing chemicals, essentially, and made an awful lot of money. He was essentially an industrial entrepreneur, and rather than buying himself a, fancy yacht or something and sailing around the world, he decided to invest his money in a proper education. He went back to university and studied what was then known as a degree in prehistory, what we would now call anthropology or something like that, and used his money to fund investigations into the evolution of humans. And in particular, what he would do was offer a reward to people who were working in quarries in Germany. If they came up with any interesting material, they would bring it to him and he would pay them for it. And in 1907, the Mauer quarry, someone came to Otto with this rather spectacular jawbone. And Otto, in his newly found life as a paleontologist, correctly identified this as another species of Homo and another extinct one. This is what we now know of as Homo heidelbergensis, named by him. And at the time, was the first really well-accepted, totally distinct species of human. Since 1907, we've obviously had a massive explosion in the activities, particularly in the last 20 or 30 years, actually, in the discovery of both fossil material and artifacts associated with humans. And this is an incredibly fast-moving field. So actually, in the time I've been talking to you, I'm sure someone's going to say I'm completely wrong. So to avoid you all putting the blame on me, I've lifted this rather nice diagram from the Natural History Museum so you can blame them for it being out of date instead. We now know that there are many, many species of now extinct Homo that have existed and have existed in parallel. So for example, here in this top corner, you can see at least four or five species that have been present on the planet at the same time for a large period of our history, but are no longer present with us today. Today, as far as we know, as I said, Homo sapiens is the only one of these to still be present. So why might that be? What has happened to drive this colonization of Homo sapiens around the world and to remove these other species? Why is it that we don't go to the supermarket and bump into a Homo heidelbergensis? And to think about that in a bit more detail, we have to think about what our most recent parallel species were like and why, therefore, they may no longer be around now. So, as far as we know at the moment, and as I say, this is undoubtedly subject to change, and I suspect very soon we'll have to revise this lecture, but as we know at the moment, there are at least four parallel species of Homo-like organism, so like ourselves, that have coexisted in relatively recent evolutionary history. And by relatively recent, I mean the last 100,000 years or so. There are cells. This is Homo sapiens and looks like a very familiar skeleton. And then the species about which we know the most, by far, are these chaps, the Neanderthals. In many ways, very, very similar. Skeleton looks very similar, same sorts of bones. Much chunkier. You can see already that the bones are thicker, that the whole body is more well-developed. And some subtle differences, particularly around the skull. And the example I like the best is that people say you can tell whether you're a Neanderthal or a Homo sapiens by standing in the rain. So if you're out standing in the rain and the rain is forming a nice sheet in front of your eyes because it's dripping off your brow ridge, then you're probably a Neanderthal and you should check in the mirror. If it's running down your face and dripping off your chin, then you're probably a Homo sapiens and you can go home safe in the knowledge you're the correct species. Because Neanderthals had a very prominent brow ridge and a receding chin, we have a negligible brow ridge and a protruding chin. So you can check your chin now in the audience if you want to make sure you are the correct species. And if not, please come to see me afterwards because it really ruins the lecture if you're a Neanderthal. So we know a lot about the Neanderthals. We have a lot of fossil material, and we have a lot of associated artifacts with their life. And as I'll show you in a minute, we also have genetic information. Then we have this little chap here. This is Homo floresiensis. We know far less about this species for two reasons, really. First of all, it was only discovered in 2003. And second of all, we have only found it on the island of Flores in Indonesia and nowhere else. And people with good memories might remember the kind of media flurry around this. It's often referred to as the Hobbit, because as you can see from this, it's very small. In fact, Homo floresiensis probably topped out at about a metre tall, so about here, somewhere like that. It was a very diminutive species of Homo, and people actually argue still a lot about where it fits. It has some characteristics that look very ancestral, much more like some human precursors, if you like, that were living perhaps 6 million years ago. But in other features, it looks relatively modern, much more like Homo sapiens, and it's a little bit unclear about the lineage of this. There's also relatively little fossil material from this species, and there have been some difficulties in studying it, and so the position of floresiensis in the kind of family tree is debated. However, the dating is pretty good, so we know that this chap was running around on the island of Flores at the time that modern Homo sapiens was elsewhere in the world. So it's certainly contemporary in time, even if it wasn't contemporary in geography. And then the fourth and final species that we know we have shared our planet with relatively recently is significantly unspectacular as a fossil, because here it is. These are the Denisovans, and the Denisovans are a quite mysterious species, living in Asia, in Siberia, in what is now Russia, essentially. And to date, this is pretty much the full extent of all the fossil material that we have. A little bit of arm or leg bone, a little bit of jaw bone, and a few teeth. From multiple individuals, though. So it's quite hard to reconstruct this. All the data we have suggests that they were probably similar in kind of physiology to you and I. So they were not very small, for example, like the Flores species. We know from dating that they were definitely around at the same time as Homo sapiens, so they were present at the same time. And we know that they are distinct from both ourselves and from Neanderthals. So we have four species, at least, that were cohabiting the planet at the same time. And our best guess is the wrong phrase, our best information so far suggests a story that looks a bit like this. And I'm going to caveat this by saying every time someone discovers new fossil material, all the dates change and a lot of the patterns of migration change. So if you're watching this on catch up in 6 months' time, it might be completely wrong. Go away and do a Google search and check. But as of today, this is our view. The view is that Around 600,000 years ago, Homo heidelbergensis, you'll remember that's the jawbone that was reported from Germany, was a sort of most recent common ancestor of modern humans, evolving in Africa about 600,000 years ago, and then from its African origins started to migrate out into Europe and ultimately into Asia. Once located in those parts of the world, like species do, and like those of you who were earlier lectures will recall, it started to diversify, and it started to, in the normal process of evolution, accumulate mutations, accumulate phenotypic change, so physical change, and natural selection did its work. The fittest organisms survived, and the unfit ones died out. So, for instance, the environment in Northern Europe, as we know, is quite different to that in Central Africa. Not least, it was a lot colder. And so selection started to act on these, and you ended up with diversification into what we now recognise to be a new species, the Neanderthals. At the same time, these early pioneers over in Asia were also under selective pressure, were also diversifying in a different direction to become what we now recognise as the Denisovans. So those are the three. And then the fourth species I mentioned, we know very little about. Here he is down here, Homo floresiensis. We know from the dating that they were present on Flores by about 74,000 years ago. We don't know at all how they got there or where they got there from. So we don't know, for example, whether these are direct descendants of any of these groups or some kind of parallel evolution or some kind of very mysterious migration from a different part of the globe. But they were nonetheless there. So had you dropped on the planet, say, 60, 70,000 years ago and had a bird's eye view, you would have seen these different populations in these different parts of the world. Meanwhile, back in Africa, Heidelbergensis is, of course, not sitting unmoved. Evolution continues to work even if you're in the same place and continues to select for traits that are beneficial. Traits in particular, like increased intellect, the ability to do things like use tools, to coordinate hunting activities, and ultimately to do all the things that makes humans a great success. These selective pressures change the way that Homo heidelbergensis looks, and ultimately leads to the evolution of what we recognise to be a different species, i.e. anatomically modern Homo sapiens, modern humans. And the date for this arrival of early humans has moved many, many times, even in the last few years. We now think that anatomically modern humans were present in parts of Africa by about 300,000 years ago, particularly based on material from what is now Morocco. And that date, again, may move. But certainly, by about this period, we had organisms living in Africa that look very much like ourselves. And just like their preceding species, Heidelbergensis, these humans too started to spread and migrate to different parts of the world. Crossing across the Middle East into Europe and then into Asia. And when they did that, of course, they realised they arrived in a place where there was already a human-like species. So in particular in Europe, there's clear evidence of anatomically modern Homo sapiens entering Europe and meeting, essentially, the indigenous Neanderthal population that was there at the time. We have less material to evidence that from Asia, but it's reasonable to expect we had a similar interaction with Denisovans and possibly even down with the Flores individuals in Indonesia. So anatomically modern humans have migrated out of Africa, they've come into these places, they've met all these other species by around 50,000 years ago. And completely by coincidence, each of these other species then goes extinct. That feels a bit like a just-so story. It seems a bit of a coincidence, doesn't it? That modern humans migrate out of Africa, and one by one, everyone who looks like us dies. And in particular, I think, if you think about the recent history of humanity, we don't have a very good track record about interacting with people in their own countries when we get there. If you think about early European settlers in pretty much any other part of the globe, that story did not end well for the people who were already there. So for a very long time, the rhetoric of modern human evolution assumed, really, I think, that the extinction of these indigenous species was a direct result of conflict with modern humans. In other words, we turned up in Europe, we spotted these Neanderthals, thought they were a bit of a pain, and killed them, and took their place. There are two reasons that that is probably not true. The first is that thus far we have no direct evidence of that at all. So, for example, no evidence of Neanderthal skeletons that have wounds inflicted by weapons. We have no evidence of mass genocide. We have nothing like that that might support that argument. And the second piece of evidence I'll tell you in a second, which suggests we might have had a much more positive relationship, at least with some of those species. So we don't actually know why those species all became extinct. There's no evidence that we deliberately eradicated them, but there are certainly several suggestions of things that might have contributed, probably in a combination, to drive these other species to extinction. The first is that this was a period of significant climate challenge, I guess, for these species. So I don't know how well this comes across. So this top graph, the blue graph here, shows average global temperature going from long ago, 800,000 years ago, to modern day here. And what you can just about see, perhaps up here in the top corner, is a long period here between about sort of 150,000 years ago and more recently of extended cold temperatures. So these had two effects. One, A, the world was colder. Secondly, it was also much drier, because when the world is cold, you lock up a lot of water into ice caps and everything becomes much drier. So one possibility is this very extended period of cold, dry weather presented a significant challenge, particularly to those human-like species that were living in colder parts of the globe. So the Neanderthals in Europe, for example, Denisovans in Siberia, may have struggled to deal with that extended period of cold in a way that perhaps anatomically modern humans did not. There is also evidence at that time for several really large volcanic eruptions, particularly in areas like what is now Italy, and down in the sort of Polynesian area and Indonesian areas, that are likely to have produced a very large quantity of smoke and ash, essentially, which has direct impacts. Obviously, it's not very nice to live in a place where you've got ash falling on you, and also indirect impacts in terms of climate change in the local region. Most of the evidence now suggests this on its own is not sufficient to explain extinction, but certainly probably wouldn't have helped the humans living in those areas. A third possibility, and one that's close to my heart, given that I spent most of my life working on infectious diseases, is that maybe this was some kind of horrendous sort of pandemic for these particular species, perhaps even one that was precipitated by the arrival of modern humans. And if you think about that, for example, when Europeans arrived in the New World, they brought with them, inadvertently at first, deliberately later, smallpox, a disease that was then endemic in Europe, but was not endemic in North America. And therefore, Native Americans had almost no resistance to smallpox, and this disease absolutely devastated the Native American population. This is a pattern that happens a lot. So one possibility is that when modern humans migrated out of Africa, they brought with them perhaps some pathogens to which they were relatively resistant, having co-evolved, but these indigenous populations, never having seen it before, were very susceptible. So maybe they eradicated inadvertently Neanderthals and others by bringing their pathogens with them. A fourth possibility, and one which has had a lot of traction in the press, I think, is about the use of tools. And until fairly recently, this was looking quite compelling, because there was a really good set of data on anatomically modern humans creating really quite elaborate tools and using them to catch and butcher animals, for example, and indeed to do things like make early clothes. And this was not something that was seen with other fossil materials. So the suggestion was maybe we were just technologically superior. We had these amazing tools and it let us, for example, hunt mammoths and other things. We always got the food and Neanderthals starved out because they couldn't compete. That has been largely poo-pooed with more recent discoveries of tools that were clearly associated with Neanderthals. And actually, the demonstration that Neanderthals could produce equally elaborate tools and indeed had control of things like fire. So actually, that technological difference between modern humans and Neanderthals is nowhere near as striking as it first looked and is probably, again, not enough to explain this. And so the last suggestion that people have made is maybe this is something about the elaborate, intelligent, cultural life that kind of characterizes Homo sapiens. And we know that a key feature of Homo sapiens is their amazing brain capacity and their ability to think about things that are quite abstract. And this is one of my favorite examples. This sculpture called the Lion Man dates back about 40,000 years and was found in Germany. was produced by Anatomically Modern Humans, we think, and is a really nice example, I think, of the level of sophistication of these primitive, in inverted commas, humans. Because this is a really nice piece of artwork that has been created by somebody that we think of as being sort of very prehistoric. But B, it also demonstrates their ability to think in abstract thoughts, because this is something that does not exist, right? We don't have bipedal lions, and never have, as far as we know of. So this is a demonstration of a fusion of ideas. We don't know why they made that. It's been speculated that perhaps it's some kind of religious significance, or maybe for some kind of cultural purpose. But nonetheless, the idea that a modern human sitting in a cave somewhere would create something that was a fusion between a human and a lion for some kind of artistic purpose, rather than as a practical tool, suggests a level of sophistication that we have not yet seen in other species. And so I said at the beginning of the lecture I wasn't going to answer my question, and I'm not, because we don't know the answer. But I guess the most plausible explanation for the extinction of these other species at this stage is some complex combination of a difficult climate and maybe a pathogen and a technological and cultural superiority. For whatever reason, though, by about 38,000 years ago, we were alone. All these other species had died out, and ever since then, as far as we know, Homo sapiens has been the only Homo species on the planet. But to end on a slightly happier note, it's not quite as straightforward as that, because in the last few years, we've learnt that although those other species are extinct, they have left a really exciting remnant. And we have learnt that from the revolution of ancient DNA technologies, particularly driven by Svante Paabo, a Swedish geneticist who's spent his life really optimising the ability to retrieve and sequence DNA from very old material, and for which he was awarded the Nobel Prize in 2022. And what Paabo and others have done is extract DNA, managed to extract DNA from this ancient material and sequence it. And in 2010, which was a dramatic year for this field, they came out with two really impressive findings. The first was they had successfully extracted and sequenced DNA to create a genome, a full genome sequence, from a Neanderthal, which was pretty revolutionary at the time. And then even more revolutionary from that, they had actually, as part of this project, been sequencing different Neanderthal material and realised that one of the pieces of material they were sent was not Neanderthal at all. And in fact, was this species I've been talking to you about, the Denisovans. And this is still the first and only example of us discovering a species of Homo by DNA sequencing technology rather than by fossil identification. Once that had been done, people looked at the bone material and realised there were subtle differences. But nonetheless, this was the first discovery of a different species. We now have extensive genome information for both of these species. We do not, sadly, have it for that additional one, the Flores skeleton. That's probably because DNA is not preserved at all well in the tropics, and so there've been attempts but no success in retrieving DNA from that sample from Indonesia, whereas these samples come from much colder climates where the DNA is preserved better. But when we have these genome sequences from these two species, together, of course, with the huge amount of genomic information we have about modern Homo sapiens, we can now do some really interesting comparisons. And the thing that was most striking as soon as this comparison was done was that it shed a huge amount of light on this early diversification and spread of our species. In particular, it validated many of the dates at which Homo sapiens, modern Homo sapiens, had left and moved around Africa. And the reason it did that was because of a pretty remarkable discovery, which is that when you compare those two sequences, those genomic sequences of Neanderthals and Denisovans with modern human genomes, you find that many of us living humans today, but not all, have bits of those genomes within us. In fact, if you're sitting in this room or listening online and you can trace your ancestry unbroken through Africa, only Africa, then you are 100% on average, 100% Homo sapiens genome. If you're like me, if you're a Eurasian, on average you're about 98% Homo sapiens, but most Eurasians carry about 2% of your genome that you've inherited from Neanderthals. And if you come from this part of the world over here, Polynesia, if you're Melanesian, you have that 2% Neanderthal and also up to about 4% Denisovan. And that means two really important things. First of all, it means that at a point in relatively recent evolutionary history, modern Homo sapiens did indeed cohabit areas with these two other species, because the second point is, it means we also interbred with them. And in fact, because we are detecting that at such high levels, we probably interbred with them quite a lot, actually. And in fact, you can see this pattern rather beautifully. This is some work fairly recently, just in the last couple of months, actually, looking at the level of Denisovan ancestry in modern humans across the world. And what you see is it's coloured from blue to red. What you see is that if you're from Africa or Europe, you have essentially no Denisovan ancestry on average. And you get more and more and more as you go across until it's peaking here at about 5% down in this part of the world here. And one of the things I quite like about this, actually, for people who are familiar with this part of the world, is a thing called Wallace's line. So Alfred Russel Wallace, working at the same time as Darwin, spotted the fact that if you look in this part of the world, the plants and animals on one side of the line are quite different to those on the other side of the line. And that is because over evolutionary time, sea level has gone up and down. And so there have been land bridges that have allowed animals and plants to migrate between these areas. But there's a very deep channel that runs here that has never dried out. And so there's been a barrier, a natural barrier, for a very long time. And so you have a distinct evolutionary history here to here. But that has not affected this climb, this migration of humans, suggesting that humans successfully navigated that stretch of water between these islands, either deliberately on boats or inadvertently by, you know, being blown across on rafts of vegetation or something. So this is a really nice piece of data suggesting that modern humans derive from some of these crosses with ancient species. And so, in fact, what we now believe is a model that looks a little bit like this. So around between 300 and 200,000 years ago, modern humans evolved in Africa. They migrated out. They met those Neanderthals, as I mentioned before. They didn't eradicate them all in some horrendous genocide. And in fact, they had quite a few romantic interactions with them. We don't, of course, have any information on whether those were coerced interactions or consensual ones or some mixture of the two. But nonetheless, what we do have is very clear genetic information that they interbred, and that then those hybrids, for want of a better word, those Neanderthal modern human hybrids, migrated further and met this new population, this Denisovan population, and did the same thing again, introducing a new set of genes and migrating further down here, which is why we all have these slightly different ancestries. And I think the most interesting thing about this was the fact that we can see it today suggests this is probably not a very uncommon event, but actually perhaps that modern humans lived side by side with these other species for a relatively extended period of time. And the final piece of the puzzle that suggests that's probably really true is this. This is the bone fragment I showed you back a few slides, one of the bone fragments from that cave in Denisova. And I said there was very little sort of fossil materials, or bone material, from these individuals. But this is one. This is either a leg or an arm, we don't know which, from a Denisovan. And it turned out, more recently, that the same team, Svante de Paavo's team, have successfully secured DNA from this and sequenced the DNA from this. When they did that, it turns out that this individual was a first-generation hybrid, not between Homo sapiens, but between Denisovans and Neanderthals. It has one Neanderthal parent and one Denisovan parent. Either we have got unbelievably lucky and found a first-generation hybrid in a sample that is absolutely tiny, or this suggests, and I would suggest that's more likely, this was a very common occurrence. And so you had Homo sapiens and Denisovans and Neanderthals all living close enough and interbreeding that now, thousands of years later, a tiny bone fragment demonstrates a first-generation mixed progeny from one of these matings, suggesting perhaps that we have had this kind of interaction many, many times up until these other species went extinct. And so that suggests that actually our family tree, if you like, is much more complicated than we used to think it was. Rather than this very nice straightforward branching and everybody else goes extinct and we're here in splendid isolation, instead, we have these frequent interbreeding events between different lineages, some of which then go extinct, but leave their genetic hallmark in modern humans. And in fact, if you're interested, you go into great detail about all the different ancestry around the world and which bits of your genome might have come from different ancient human lineages. It's quite a fascinating dig. And so rather than thinking of human evolution as this kind of biblical pinnacle of success with a single species at the top. We're in fact much more like this really complicated branching tree with lots of cross branches. And perhaps now, you know, for this moment in time, we are on our own as this species. But who knows, roll the clock on another 100,000 years, we might have all sorts of interesting diversification still coming. And on that note, thank you very much for listening. I'm very happy to take any questions.
That conclusion is quite striking because it strikes me there's a couple of larger possibilities that can come from it. So would you say that maybe we have to start rethinking our idea of what species means? Can we be quite so sort of discrete or isolationist about it?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And I think, so this, I said at the beginning that this biological species concept is defined by organisms that breed together and can't breed with anybody else. And then I've just told you that we've got this repeated interbreeding between groups. So one argument would be to say these are actually not distinct species at all. And we were all one big kind of blended group. And I think to a certain extent, this is a sort of semantic argument. And the example I always use is domestic dogs are a single species, right? They're one species. However, out there in the wild, if you've distributed them, a Great Dane and a Chihuahua are very unlikely to form stable, long-lasting species reproduction, for quite obvious reasons. And so, if you like, you could play that through and say, oh, these are kind of incipient species that are about to branch out. And maybe this is what we're seeing here, is a snapshot in time when these different human lineages were kind of almost separate, but not quite, and then have gone. What they haven't done, just on that, is we obviously haven't completely introgressed as geneticists, so we haven't amalgamated again because we only have, you know, 2 or 3 or 4% of these other genomes. So it's not, we're not a blend of all these species back again. There's still very much a Homo sapiens species with a little bit of other things in. But the fact we have interbred does suggest that the species barrier was certainly not black and white.
Hi, thank you for your lecture. In the context of what you've just told us, could you say something about what race means?
I'd prefer not to. So the first thing to say, biologically, race is completely meaningless. Doesn't mean anything at all. And it's a word, obviously, that has massive cultural connotations, many of them quite negative. So I think there's probably two things to say. As an identification of kind of cultural belonging, it means a lot to some people. People have, you know, very strong feelings one way or another. They're either, you know, yes, I'm completely in this group, or no, I'm not. As a something you can look at biologically, it's pretty meaningless. And actually, genetically, it is almost impossible. So if we look, you know, if I look around this room, for example, around the world, people belong to what historically people might have called different races. Genetically, you wouldn't see that. So there are far more differences within groups than there are between groups. There are certain traits associated with certain people from certain parts of the world, but not enough to say, you know, this is one particular group and this is another particular group. So it's fairly meaningless biologically. The place where it probably has played out in evolutionary sense is actually around that self-determination idea. So for example, what sometimes happens in groups of diversifying organisms is that they have breeding patterns, endogamy it's called, so when you breed with like similar groups. And so you see that in humanity, right? So there are some groups, religious groups, cultural groups, whatever, where you are encouraged to marry and reproduce within your group and not outside your group. If you play that through for thousands of years, that might end up in diversification because you've got this genetic isolation. In reality, of course, what's happened is precisely the opposite, and we now all fly around the world and, you know, ignore that completely. So it has a sort of self-defining, if you like, role in terms of the way that people interact with each other, but it's not a biologically meaningful thing at all.
What sort of numbers of these species were there on the planet interbreeding at this time? And ooh, where's that one? And yeah, and for how many years roughly were these species coexisting?
Right, so in terms of numbers, so all we can say with confidence, for example, if I take Floresiensis as the best example, we have only found Floresiensis in Flores in Indonesia, and I think it's something like 100 individuals have been found, so they might have been locally common, but they certainly weren't globally common, or if they were, we haven't found them anywhere else, which seems to be unlikely. Neanderthals, we have a huge amount of tissue material from right across sort of Western Europe and into part of Eastern Europe. They were probably relatively abundant in that area, but only in that area. There's no Neanderthal material from other parts of the world. Denis Avens, we have very little information about. They've been found in a couple of locations, again, very fragmentary material. Although the fact that there is quite a large genetic presence in modern human populations might suggest that they were relatively abundant. But, I mean, it's all a bit hand-wavy, to be perfectly honest. In terms of how long they might have cohabited, for want of a better word, that is strongly contested and a bit unclear. So you can put boundaries on it. So if you imagine that modern humans emerged from Africa and crossed over, say, 60-ish thousand years ago, and everyone was extinct by 38,000 years ago, can't be more than about 30,000 years. Probably it was much, much shorter. There is some evidence, there are some caves where there is material that looks like it was produced by both Homo sapiens and Neanderthals, extending over a reasonably long period of time. So there's a suggestion that we might have cohabited in certain sites, possibly for a couple of thousand years. But I mean, this is very sort of, you know, open to negotiation, I think. So possibly a reasonable length of time, but in terms of evolutionary time, kind of a very short snapshot.
You mentioned about no distinction on the question of race, genetically or biologically. Hair, for instance, does distinguish between races, doesn't it?
No, not really. So I guess this comes slightly to the point about whether... So there are traits that are more common in some populations than in other populations. So, for instance, there are some populations in Africa where there is a disproportionately high number of people who can run really fast, right? You can see that, in represented in kind of international sports. That does not mean that if you come from that part of Africa, that you're going to be an Olympic gold medalist. And so there are associations with certain traits, but there is no black and white sort of thing that is associated with what people might term a race or a tribe or something like that. And a good example is blonde hair. So, for example, if you look around the world, blonde hair, so there's lots of blonde hair in sort of Europe, not very much blonde hair in Africa, but there are still individual people who have blonde hair, and particularly in, yes, exactly, or curly hair or all these kind of different things. So there are no traits that would kind of stamp someone as being a particular thing. There are things that are more common or less common. And that's what you see genetically as well, is that you can... if you have fossil material, you can make assumptions about that individual's, skin colour, for instance, but you can't definitively... You can't do the other way around. You can't say, because this skin colour is here, that person must have been part of this group. Yeah, it applies to pretty much everything. Eye colour, all sorts of things. So there are traits that are much more common than in some areas than others. But essentially, we are a big and interesting genetic mixing pool, which I think is fab.
One question asks, have we lost most of the Neanderthal and Denisovan? Is that right?
Denisovan
genes because we were better adapted and they were not adaptive, to which I might add something like, is it actually, on a more positive spin, Homo sapiens' capacity for assimilation that actually helped them more. So is it sort of adaptive capacity, assimilatory capacity?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the short answer is it goes in both directions. So, for instance, there are some genes in the modern human population. So there's a gene that is an HLA gene. So this is a gene that helps your immune system essentially recognize something that is foreign. And one of these come in different flavors. And one of the really fascinating things is that there's a particular flavor of HLA allele, it's called, that is quite common in modern Homo sapiens and appears to have a relatively recent evolutionary ancestry. And it turns out that is because that's actually a Denisovan allele. So that looks like an example where we have interbred, we've picked up a gene that had a benefit to us, and therefore it's spread rapidly. There are also examples the other way around. So there are particular genes that we can see in the Neanderthal genome that are not represented at all, suggesting that they were actually deleterious, that they were damaging in this kind of process. So that might be, for example, something that led to some kind of incompatibility in reproduction. So you have in other species, you see things like male sterility, where you have particular genes that just don't work in a different host, and so they cause a loss of reproductive capacity. Those kind of things we see. So essentially, the short answer to that very long-winded answer that I just gave you is there are genes that have been beneficial to us and genes that have not, and those ones have been lost through evolutionary processes.
And This is probably a long shot. I think I can imagine what the answer is going to be, but I'm going to ask it anyway because it's quite an interesting one. Was the interbreeding between Homo sapiens, Neanderthal, Denisovan, was it driven more by the males or the females of the species?
Not sure there's a safe answer to that question, is there? The short answer is we don't know. So there are examples in both directions, as far as I'm aware, where you can see, so you can track in the genome whether that inheritance has come from a male or female lineage based on the genes that are there. And I'm just trying to think off the top of my head. I think there are examples in both directions. I don't think we have enough data to see whether there is a preponderance of one way or the other in that period. And the fact that the fossil I just showed you at the end, which is this Neanderthal-Denisovan hybrid, for want of a better word, we certainly don't have enough material like that to be able to really say this was a particular bias. So don't know is the short answer.
Okay. Well played.
Can you tell us what happened to Homo erectus?
Yes. So Homo erectus, probably... So we don't have Homo erectus anymore, but as far as we can tell, that was not due to a dramatic extinction. It's probably a species that has essentially evolved and morphed into later species and has slowly been lost over time rather than being displaced and eliminated. So there are, back on the slide I showed you previously, there are some lineages where we see a sort of abrupt end and they disappear. That's not true for Homo erectus. And so that is thought of as a species that essentially just diversified into more modern humans. And so we're all, to a first approximation, just descendants of Homo erectus.
Does all this help us understand ourselves as modern humans? Does it help us understand our kind of psychology, our mental health, our cognitive development better? And does it tell us, is there any possibility that we might continue to evolve and that indeed Homo sapiens might split into to different sorts of humans in the future?
Great. So on the first one, I like to think it does. And I think one of the things I most like about this is it demonstrates the complete stupidity of so many sort of human ideas that have been so negative over recent human history, right? The idea that, you know, someone asked about race earlier, the idea that there's some kind of, you know, superior race and inferior race is clearly complete nonsense. The idea that, you know, we are somehow all very distinct and need to keep to our own entities, we're actually been a massive genetic mixing pot, you know, for thousands of years. And also, I think perhaps the lesson that, you know, it doesn't matter how optimal you are, your time in the kind of sun will come and go. You know, there was a time when Neanderthals were the dominant species in Europe and they're not around anymore. We're around. We probably are not going to be around forever. So, you know, make the most of it. So yes, I like to think there's a kind of positive story here. There's also a very negative spin. You know, we kind of roamed the world and eradicated people and, you know, maybe had forced matings and all sorts of negative things. But let's stick to the positive answer. In terms of future evolution, stick with the program, whoever asked that question. Coming up in a lecture to you very soon, I think not the next one, but the one after that, we're going to talk a bit about where we might go. Spoiler alert, yes, absolutely. I mean, evolution doesn't stop, so I'm sure we'll be evolving in all sorts of interesting ways, but you'll have to stick around and see at least what I think about that. It's open to be shot down in flames when everyone disagrees with it.
Sorry, I just wanted to ask about your Homo heidelbergus, who you think developed in Africa and then moved out and diversified. So the Heidelberg jaw that was found, is that an ancestor? Is it older than the Neanderthals, or were they still around at this time of?
Yes, so that's a very good question. So it is older, but it's a little bit unclear whether how it got there, where it came from, or how common it was to have those species there. It is probably an early Heidelbergensis that arrived before diversifying into these Neanderthal populations later on. In terms of Heidelbergensis in Africa, we now have good material from, so the oldest material I think is up in Morocco, and then, yeah, I'm trying to remember my dates, I think then Ethiopia is a bit younger, and South Africa younger again. So there's a suggestion that there was a sort of migration evolution of Heidelbergensis down through Africa at the same time as it went out and across into Europe. But with all of these things, the dating is, you know, there's a lot of... People get very worked up about dating, there's a lot of, you know, flexibility there. And, you know, as new technologies develop and new material becomes available, the dates change quite radically. So don't hold me to that, is my get-out clause.
Professor Robin May, thank you very much.
Thank you.